unwanted task is to inform you that the events I recently told you about were neither a fabrication of mine nor the dubious reminiscences of an old man, but are the complete and solemn truth in every particular. As you know, the war ended a very long time ago, and memory naturally degenerates as the years go by. Memories and thoughts age, just as people do. But certain thoughts can never age, and certain memories can never fade. Up to and including this very day, I have never told any of these things to anyone but you, Mr. Okada. To most people, these stories of mine would sound like the most incredible fabrications. The majority of people dismiss those things that lie beyond the bounds of their own understanding as absurd and not worth thinking about. I myself can only wish that my stories were indeed nothing but incredible fabrications. I have stayed alive all these years, clinging to the frail hope that these memories of mine were nothing but a dream or a delusion. I have struggled to convince myself that they never happened. But each time I tried to push them into the dark, they came back stronger and more vivid than ever. Like cancer cells, these memories have taken root in my mind and eaten into my flesh. Even now I can recall each tiny detail with such terrible clarity. I feel I am remembering events that happened just yesterday. I can hold the sand and the grass in my hands. I can even smell them. I can see the shapes of the clouds in the sky. I can feel the dry, sandy wind against my cheeks. By comparison, it is the subsequent events of my life that seem like delusions on the borderline between dream and reality. The very roots of my life, those things that I can say once truly belonged to me alone, were frozen stiff or burned away out there on the steppes of Outer Mongolia, where there was nothing to obstruct one's vision as far as the eye could see. Afterwards, I lost my hand in that fierce battle with the Soviet tank unit that attacked across the border. I tasted unimaginable hardships in a Siberian labor camp in the dead of winter. I was repatriated and served for 30 uneventful years as a social studies teacher in a rural high school, and I have since lived alone, tilling the land. But all those subsequent months and years felt to me like nothing but an illusion. It is as if they never happened. In an instant, my memory leaps across that empty shell of time and takes me back to the wilds of Ulaanbaatar. What cost me my life, what turned it into that empty shell, I believe, was something in the light I saw at the bottom of the well. That intense light of the sun that penetrated to the very bottom of the well for 10 or 20 seconds. It would come without warning and disappear just as suddenly. But in that momentary flood of light I saw something once and for all that I could never see again as long as I lived. And having seen it, I was no longer the same person I had been. What happened down there? What did it mean? Even now, more than 40 years later, I cannot answer those questions with any certainty. Which is why what I am about to say is strictly a hypothesis, a tentative explanation that I have fashioned for myself without the benefit of any logical basis. I do believe, however, that this hypothesis of mine is, for now, the closest that anyone can come to the truth of what it was that I experienced. Outer Mongolian troops had thrown me into a deep, dark well in the middle of the steppe. My leg and shoulder were broken. I had neither food nor water. I was simply waiting to die. Before that, I had seen a man skinned alive. Under these special circumstances, I believe my consciousness had attained such a viscid state of concentration that when the intense beam of light shone down for those few seconds, I was able to descend into a place that might be called the very core of my own consciousness. In any case, I saw the shape of something there. Just imagine, everything around me is bathed in light. I am in the very center of a flood of light. My eyes can see nothing. I am simply enveloped in light. But something begins to appear there. In the midst of my momentary blindness, something is trying to take shape. Something. Something that possesses life. Like the shadow in a solar eclipse, it begins to emerge black in the light. But I can never quite make out its form. It is trying to come to me, trying to confer upon me something very much like heavenly grace. I wait for it, trembling. But then, either because it has changed its mind or because there is not enough time, it never comes to me. The moment before it takes full shape, it dissolves and melts once again into the light. Then the light itself fades. The time for the light to shine down into the well has ended. This happened 2 days in a row. Exactly the same thing. Something began to take shape in the overflowing light, then faded before it could reach a state of fullness. Down in the well I was suffering from hunger and thirst, suffering terribly. But finally, this was not of primary importance. What I suffered from most down there in the world was the torture of being unable to attain a clear view of that something in the light, the hunger of being unable to see what I needed to see, the thirst of being unable to know what I needed to know. Had I been able to see it clearly, I would not have minded dying right then and there. I truly felt that way. I would have sacrificed anything for a full view of its form. Finally, though, the form was snatched away from me forever. The grace came to an end before it could be given to me. And as I said earlier, the life I led after emerging from that hole in the ground was nothing but a hollow, empty shell. Which is why, when the Soviet army invaded Manchuria just before the end of the war, I volunteered to be sent to the front. In the Siberian labor camp, too, I purposely strove to have myself placed in the most difficult circumstances. No matter what I did, however, I could not die. Just as Corporal Honda had predicted that night, I was fated to return to Japan and live an amazingly long life. I remember how happy that news made me when I first heard it. But it turned out to be, if anything, a curse. It was not that I would not die. I could not die. Corporal Honda had been right about that, too. I would have been better off not knowing. When the revelation and the grace were lost, my life was lost. Those living things that had once been there inside me, that had been for that reason of some value, were dead now. Not a single thing was left. They had all been burned to ashes in that fierce light. The heat emitted by that revelation or grace had seared away the very core of the life that made me the person I was. Surely I had lacked the strength to resist that heat, and so I feel no fear of death. If anything, my physical death would be, for me, a form of salvation. It would liberate me forever from this hopeless prison. This pain of being me. Again I have burdened you with an overlong tale, I beg your forgiveness. But what I want to convey to you, Mr. Okada, is this. I happened to lose my life at one particular moment in time, and I have gone on living these 40 years or more with my life lost. As a person who finds himself in such a position, I have come to think that life is a far more limited thing than those in the midst of its maelstrom realize. The light shines into the act of life for only the briefest moment, perhaps only a matter of seconds. Once it is gone and one has failed to grasp its offered revelation, there is no second chance. One may have to live the rest of one's life in hopeless depths of loneliness and remorse. In that twilight world, one can no longer look forward to anything. All that such a person holds in his hands is the withered corpse of what should have been. In any case, I am grateful for the chance to have met you, Mr. Okada, and to have told you my story. Whether it will ever be of any use to you, I cannot be certain. But by telling it to you, I feel that I have attained a kind of salvation. Frail and tenuous though it may be, to me any kind of salvation is a treasure. Nor can I help sensing the presence of the subtle threads of fate in the fact that Mr. Honda was the one who guided me to it. Please remember, Mr. Okada, that there is someone here sending his best wishes to you for a happy life in the years to come.
I read through the letter one more time with care and returned it to its envelope. Lieutenant Mamiya's letter moved my heart in strange ways, but to my mind it brought only vague and distant images. Lieutenant Mamiya was a man I could trust and accept, and I could also accept as fact those things that he declared to be facts. But the very concept of fact, or truth, had little power to persuade me just then. What most moved me in his letter was the sense of frustration that permeated the lieutenant's words, the frustration of never quite being able to depict or explain anything to his full satisfaction. I went to the kitchen for a drink of water. Then I wandered around the house. In the bedroom I sat on the bed and looked at Kumiko's dresses lined up in the wardrobe, and I thought, what has been the point of my life until now? I saw what Noboru Wataya had been talking about. My first reaction to his words had been anger, but I had to admit that he was right. "You have been married to my sister for 6 years," he had said. "And what have you done in all that time? Nothing, right? All you've accomplished in 6 long years is to leave your job and ruin Kumiko's life. Now you're out of work and you have no plans for the future. There's nothing inside that head of yours but garbage and rocks." I had no choice but to admit the accuracy of his remarks. Objectively speaking, I had done nothing meaningful in these 6 years, and what I had in my head was indeed something very like garbage and rocks. I was a zero, just as he had said. But was it true that I had ruined Kumiko's life? For a long time I looked at her dresses and blouses and skirts. They were the shadows Kumiko had left behind. Bereft of their owner, these shadows could only hang where they were, limp. I went to the bathroom and took out the bottle of Christian Dior cologne that someone had given to Kumiko. I opened it and smelled it. It was the fragrance I had smelled behind Kumiko's ears the morning she had left the house. I slowly poured the entire contents into the sink. As the liquid flowed down the drain, a strong smell of flowers, the exact name of which I tried but failed to recall, hung over the sink, stirring up memories with brutal intensity. In the midst of this intense aroma, I washed my face and brushed my teeth. Then I decided to go to Mei Kasahara's. As always, I stood in the alley at the back of the Miyawaki house, waiting for Mei Kasahara to appear. But this time, it didn't work. I leaned against the fence, sucked on a lemon drop, looked at the bird sculpture, and thought about Lieutenant Mamiya's letter. Soon, however, it began to grow dark. After waiting close to half an hour, I gave up. Mei Kasahara must be out somewhere. I made my way back down the alley to the rear of my house and scaled the wall. Inside, I found the place filled with the hushed, pale darkness of a summer evening. And Krita Kano was there. For one hallucinatory moment, I felt I was dreaming, but no, this was the continuation of reality. A subtle trace of the cologne I had spilled still floated in the air. Krita Kano was sitting on the sofa, her hands on her knees. I drew closer to her, but as if time itself had stopped inside her, she made not the slightest movement. I turned on the light and sat in the chair facing her.
"The door was unlocked," she said at last. "I let myself in."
"That's all right," I said. "I usually leave the door unlocked when I go out." She wore a lacy white blouse, flouncy mauve skirt, and large earrings. On her left wrist she wore a large pair of matching bracelets. The sight of them sent a shock through me. They were virtually identical to the bracelets I had seen her wearing in my dream. Her hair and makeup were both done in her habitual style. Hairspray held the hair perfectly in place as usual, as if she'd just arrived from the beauty salon.
"There is not much time," she said. "I have to return home right away, but I wanted to be sure I had a chance to talk with you, Mr. Okada. You saw my sister and Mr. Wataya today, I believe."
I certainly did. Not that it was the most amusing little gathering.
"Isn't there something you would like to ask me in connection with that?"
she asked. All kinds of people were coming to me with all kinds of questions. "I'd like to know more about Noboru Wataya," I said. "I can't help thinking that I have to know more about him." She nodded.
"I would like to know more about Mr. Wataya myself. I believe that my sister has already told you that he defiled me once, a very long time ago. I don't have time to go into that today, but I will on some future occasion. In any case, it was something done to me against my will. It had originally been arranged for me to have relations with him, which is why it was not rape in the ordinary sense of the word. But he did defile me, and that changed me as a person in many important ways. In the end, I was able to recover from the experience. Indeed, it enabled me, with the help of Multicano, of course, to bring myself to a whole new, higher level. Whatever the end results may have been, the fact remains that Noboru Wataya violated and defiled me at that time against my will. What he did to me was wrong and dangerous. The potential was there for me to have been lost forever. Do you see what I mean?"
I did not see what she meant.
"Of course, I had relations with you too, Mr. Okada, but it was something done in the correct way, with a correct purpose. I was in no way defiled by that."
I looked straight at her for several seconds, as if staring at a wall with colored blotches.
"You had relations with me?"
"Yes," she said. "The first time I only used my mouth, but the second time we had relations. In the same room, both times. You remember, of course. We had so little time on the first occasion, we had to hurry. There was more time to spare on the second occasion."
It was impossible for me to reply to her.
"I was wearing your wife's dress the second time, the blue one, and bracelets like these on my left arm. Isn't that true?"
She held her left wrist, with the pair of bracelets, out towards me. I nodded. Krita Kano then said,
"Of course, we did not have relations in reality. When you ejaculated, it was not into me, physically, but in your own consciousness. Do you see? It was a fabricated consciousness. Still, the two of us share the consciousness of having had relations with each other."
"What's the point of doing something like that?"
"To know,"
she said.
"To know more, and more deeply."
I sighed. This was crazy. But she had been describing the scene of my dream with incredible accuracy. Running my finger around my mouth, I stared at the two bracelets on her left wrist. "Maybe I'm not very smart," I said, my voice dry, "but I really can't claim to have understood everything you've been telling me.
In your second dream, when I was in the middle of having relations with you, another woman took my place. Isn't that true? I have no idea who she was, but that event was probably meant to suggest something to you, Mr. Okada. This is what I wanted to convey to you.
I said nothing in return.
You should have no sense of guilt about having had relations with me,
said Krita Kano.
You see, Mr. Okada, I am a prostitute. I used to be a prostitute of the flesh, but now I am a prostitute of the mind. Things pass through me.
At this point, Krita Kano left her seat and went down on her knees beside me, clutching my hand in both of hers. She had soft, warm, very small hands.
Please hold me, Mr. Okada. Right here and now.
We stood up and I put my arms around her. I honestly had no idea whether I should be doing this, but holding Krita Kano just then, just there, did not seem to be a mistake. I could not have explained it, but that was how I felt. I wrapped my arms around her slender body as if I were taking my first lesson in ballroom dancing. She was a small woman. The top of her head came just past the bottom of my chin. Her breasts pressed against my stomach. She held her cheek against my chest, and although she made no sound the whole time, she was crying. I could feel the warmth of her tears through my t-shirt. I looked down to see her perfectly set hair trembling. I felt I was having a well-made dream, but it was not a dream. After we had stayed in that position without moving for a very long time, she pulled away from me as if she had suddenly remembered something. Maintaining her distance, she looked at me.
"Thank you so much, Mr. Okada,"
she said.
"I will be going home now."
She had just been crying with some intensity, but her makeup had hardly been disturbed. A sense of reality was now strangely absent. "Will you be in my dreams again sometime?" I asked.
"I don't know,"
she said with a gentle shake of the head.
"Not even I can tell you that. But please have faith in me. Whatever might happen, please don't be afraid of me, or feel you must be on your guard where I am concerned. Will you promise me that, Mr. Okada?"
I answered with a nod. Soon afterwards, Krita Kano went home. The darkness of night was thicker than ever. The front of my t-shirt was soaking wet. I stayed up until dawn, unable to sleep. I didn't feel sleepy for one thing, and in fact I was afraid to sleep. I had the feeling that if I were to go to sleep I would be enveloped in a flow of shifting sand that would carry me off to another world from which I would never be able to return. I stayed on the sofa until morning, drinking brandy and thinking about Krita Kano's story. Even after the night had ended, the presence of Krita Kano and the fragrance of Christian Dior eau de cologne lingered in the house like captive shadows.
5. Views of distant towns. Eternal half moon. Ladder in place. The telephone rang at almost the exact moment I was falling asleep. I tried to ignore it, but as if it could read my mind, it kept up its stubborn ringing. 10 times, 20 times, it was never going to stop. Finally, I opened one eye and looked at the clock. Just after 6 in the morning. Beyond the window shone the full light of day. The call might be from Kumiko. I got out of bed, went to the living room, and picked up the receiver. "Hello," I said, but the caller said nothing. Somebody was obviously there, but the person did not speak. I, too, kept silent. Concentrating hard, I could just make out the sound of breathing. "Who is it?" I asked, but the silence continued at the other end. "If this is the person who's always calling, do me a favor and make it a little later," I said. "No sex talk before breakfast, please."
"The person who's always calling?"
blurted out the voice of Mei Kasahara.
"Who do you talk about sex with?"
Nobody, I said.
The woman you were holding in your arms last night? You talk about sex with her on the telephone?
No, she's not the one.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, just how many women do you have hanging around you, apart from your wife?
That would be a very long story, I said. Anyhow, it's 6 in the morning and I haven't had much sleep. So you came to my house last night, huh?
And I saw you with her, holding each other.
That didn't mean a thing, I said. How can I put it? It was a kind of little ceremony.
You don't have to make excuses to me, said Mei Kasahara. I'm not your wife. It's none of my business, but let me just say this. You've got a problem.
You may be right, I said.
You're having a tough time now, I know that, but I can't help thinking it's something you've brought on yourself. You've got some really basic problem, and it attracts trouble like a magnet. Any woman with any sense would get the hell away from you.
You may be right, I said again. Mei Kasahara maintained a brief silence on her end of the line. Then she cleared her throat once and said,
You came to the alley last night, didn't you? Standing for a long time at the back of my house, like some amateur burglar? Don't worry. I saw you there.
So why didn't you come out?
A girl doesn't always want to go out, you know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Sometimes she feels like being nasty. Like if the guy's gonna wait, let him really wait.
I grunted.
But I still felt bad,
she went on.
So I dragged myself all the way to your house later, like an idiot.
And I was holding the woman.
Yeah, but isn't she a bit cuckoo? Nobody dresses like that anymore. And that makeup of hers, she's like in a time warp or something. She should get her head examined.
Don't worry, I said. She's not cuckoo. Different people have different tastes.
Well, yes. People can have any taste they want, but ordinary people don't go that far just for taste. She's like, what, right out of an old magazine. Everything about her, from head to foot.
To that, I did not reply.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, did you sleep with her?
I hesitated a moment and said, No, I didn't.
Really?
Really. I don't have that kind of physical relationship with her.
So why were you holding her?
Women feel that way sometimes. They want to be held.
Maybe so,
said Mei Kasahara.
But an idea like that can be a little dangerous.
It's true, I said.
What's her name?
Krita Kano. Mei Kasahara fell silent at her end.
You're kidding, right?
She said at last. Not at all. And her sister's name is Malta Kano.
Malta? That can't be her real name.
No, it isn't. It's her professional name.
What are they, a comedy team? Or do they have some connection with the Mediterranean Sea?
Actually, there is some connection with the Mediterranean.
Does the sister dress like a normal person?
Pretty much, I said. Her clothing is a lot more normal than Krita's, at least, except she always wears this red vinyl hat.
Something tells me she's not exactly normal either. Why do you always have to go out of your way to hang around with such off-the-wall people?
Now, that really would be a long story. If everything settles down sometime, I may be able to tell you, but not now. My head is too messed up, and things are even more messed up.
Yeah, sure,
she said with a note of suspicion in her voice.
Anyway, your wife hasn't come back yet, has she?
No, not yet.
You know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, you're a grown man. Why don't you use your head a little bit? If your wife had changed her mind and come home last night, she would have seen you with your arms locked around this woman. Then what?
True, that was a possibility.
And if she had been the one making this call, not me, and you started talking about telephone sex, what would she have thought about that?
You're right, I said.
I'm telling you, you've got a problem.
She said with a sigh. It's true, I do have a problem.
Stop agreeing with everything I say. It's not as if you're going to solve everything by admitting your mistakes. Whether you admit them or not, mistakes are mistakes.
It's true, I said. It was true.
I can't stand it anymore,
said Mei Kasahara.
Anyway, tell me, what did you want last night? You came to my house looking for something, right?
Oh, that. Never mind.
Never mind?
Yeah, finally it's... Never mind.
In other words, she gave you a hug so you don't need me anymore?
No, that's not it. It just seemed to me... At which point, Mei Kasahara hung up. Terrific. Mei Kasahara, Multicano, Krita Kano, the telephone woman, and Kumiko. Mei Kasahara was right. I had just a few too many women around me these days, and each one came packaged with her own special, inscrutable problem. But I was too tired to think. I had to get some sleep. And there was something I would have to do when I woke up. I went back to bed and fell asleep. When I did wake up, I took a knapsack from the drawer. It was the one we kept for earthquakes and other emergencies that might require evacuation. Inside was a water bottle, biscuits, a torch, and a lighter. Kumiko had bought it when we moved into this house just in case the big one should hit. The water bottle was empty, though. The biscuits were soggy and the torch batteries were dead. I filled the bottle with water, threw away the biscuits, and put new batteries in the torch. Then I went to the local hardware store and bought one of those rope ladders they sell as emergency fire escapes. I thought about what else I might need, but nothing came to mind, besides lemon drops. I went through the house, shutting windows and turning off lights. I made sure the front door was locked, but then I reconsidered. Somebody might come looking for me while I was gone. Kumiko might come back, and besides, there was nothing here worth stealing. I left a note on the kitchen table. Gone for a while, will return, tea. I wondered what it would be like for Kumiko to find this note. How would she take it? I crumpled it up and wrote a new one. Have to go out for a while on important business. Back soon. Please wait. Tea. Wearing chinos, a short-sleeved polo shirt, and carrying the knapsack, I stepped down into the yard from the veranda. All around me were the unmistakable signs of summer, the genuine article, without reservations or conditions. The glow of the sun, the smell of the breeze, the blue of the sky, the shape of the clouds, the whirring of the cicadas. Everything announced the authentic arrival of summer. And there I was, a pack on my back, scaling the garden wall and dropping down into the alley. Once as a kid, I'd run away from home on a beautiful summer morning just like this. I couldn't recall what had led me to my decision to go. I was probably mad at my parents. I left home with a knapsack on my back and in my pockets all the money I had saved. I told my mother I would be hiking with some friends and got her to make a lunch for me. There were good hills for hiking just above our house, and kids often went climbing in them without adult supervision. Once I was out of the house, I got on the bus and rode it to the end of the line. To me, this was a strange and distant town. Here I transferred to another bus and rode it to yet another strange and distant, still more distant, town. Without even knowing the name of the place, I got off the bus and wandered through the streets. There was nothing special about this particular town. It was a little more lively than the neighborhood where I lived, and a little more run down. It had a street lined with shops and a commuter train station and a few small factories. A stream ran through the town, and facing the stream stood a cinema. A board outside announced they were showing a western. At noon, I sat on a park bench and ate my lunch. I stayed in the town until early evening, and when the sun began to sink, my heart did too. This is your last chance to go back, I told myself. Once it gets completely dark, you might never be able to leave here. I went home on the same buses that had brought me there. I arrived before 7, and no one noticed that I had run away. My parents had thought I was out in the hills with the other kids. I had forgotten all about that particular event. But the moment I found myself scaling the wall, wearing a knapsack, the feeling came back to me. The indescribable loneliness I had felt, standing by myself amid unfamiliar streets and unfamiliar people and unfamiliar houses, watching the afternoon sun lose its light bit by bit. And then I thought of Kumiko. Kumiko, who had disappeared somewhere, taking with her only her shoulder bag and her blouse and skirt from the cleaners. She had missed her last chance to turn back. and now she was probably standing by herself in some strange and distant town. I could hardly bear to think of her that way. But no, she couldn't be by herself. She had to be with a man. That was the only way this made sense. I stopped thinking about Kumiko. I made my way down the alley. The grass underfoot had lost the living, breathing greenness it had seemed to possess during the spring rains, and now it wore the dull look typical of summer grass. From among these blades, a green grasshopper would leap out now and then as I walked along. Sometimes even frogs would jump away. The alley had become the world of these little creatures, and I was simply an intruder come to upset the prevailing order. When I reached the Miyawaki's vacant house, I opened the gate and walked in without hesitation. I pressed on through the tall grass to the middle of the yard, past the dingy bird statue which continued to stare at the sky, and walked around to the side of the house, hoping that Mei Kasahara had not seen me come in. The first thing I did when I got to the well was to remove the stones that held the cap on, then take off one of the two wooden half-circles. To make sure there was still no water at the bottom, I threw in a pebble, as I had done before, and as before, the pebble hit with a dry thud. There was no water. I set down the knapsack, took the rope ladder out, and tied one end of it to the trunk of the nearby tree. I pulled on it as hard as I could to be sure it would hold. This was something on which it was impossible to lavish too much care. If, by some chance, the ladder got loose or came undone, I would probably never make it back to the surface. Holding the mass of rope in my arms, I began to lower the ladder into the well. The whole of its length went in, but I never felt it hit the bottom. It couldn't possibly be too short. I had bought the longest rope ladder they made, but the well was a deep one. I shone the torch straight down inside, but I couldn't see whether or not the ladder had reached bottom. The rays of light penetrated only so far, and then they were swallowed up by the darkness. I sat on the edge of the well curb and listened. A few cicadas were screaming in the trees as if competing to see which had the loudest voice or the greatest lung capacity. I couldn't hear any birds, though. I recalled the wind-up bird with some fondness. Maybe it didn't like competing with the cicadas and had moved off somewhere to avoid them. I turned my palms upward in the sunlight. In an instant, they felt warm, as though the light were seeping into the skin, soaking into the very lines of my fingerprints. The light ruled over everything out here. Bathed in light, each object glowed with the brilliant color of summer. Even intangibles such as time and memory shared the goodness of the summer light. I popped a lemon drop in my mouth and went on sitting there until it had melted away. Then I pulled hard on the ladder one more time to be sure it was firmly anchored. Making my way down the rope ladder into the well was much harder work than I had imagined it would be. A blend of cotton and nylon, the ladder was unquestionably sturdy, but my footing on the thing was unstable. The rubber bottoms of my tennis shoes would slip whenever I tried to lower my weight onto either leg. My hands had to keep such a tight grip on the rope that my palms started to hurt. I let myself down slowly and carefully, one rung at a time. No matter how far I went, though, there was no bottom. My descent seemed to take forever. I reminded myself of the sound of the pebble hitting bottom. The well did have a bottom. Working my way down this damned ladder was what took so much time. When I had counted 20 rungs, a wave of terror overtook me. It came suddenly, like an electric shock, and froze me in place. My muscles turned to stone. Every pore of my body gushed sweat, and my legs began to tremble. There was no way this well could be so deep. This was the middle of Tokyo. It was right behind the house I lived in. I held my breath and listened, but I couldn't hear a thing. The pounding of my heart reverberated in my ears with such force I couldn't even hear the cicadas screaming up above. I took a deep breath. Here I was, on the 20th rung, unable either to proceed farther down or to climb back up. The air in the well was chilling and smelled of the earth. It was a separate world down here, one cut off from the surface, where the sun shone so unstintingly. I looked up to the mouth of the well above me, tiny now. The well's circular opening was cut exactly in half by the half of the wooden cover I had left in place. From below, it looked like a half moon floating in the night sky. A half moon will last for several days, Multicano had said. She had predicted it on the telephone. Terrific. And when the thought crossed my mind, I felt some strength leave my body. My muscles relaxed, and the solid block of breath inside me released and came out. Summoning one last spurt of strength, I started down the ladder again. Just a little farther down, I told myself. Just a little more. Don't worry, there is a bottom. And at the 23rd rung, I reached it. My foot came in contact with the earth at the bottom of the well. The first thing I did in the darkness was to feel around the surface of the well bottom with the tip of my shoe, still holding onto the ladder in case there was something down there I had to get away from. After making sure there was no water and nothing of a suspicious nature, I stepped onto the ground. Setting my pack down, I felt for the zip and took out my torch. The glow of the light gave me my first clear view of the place. The surface of the ground was neither very hard nor very soft, and fortunately the earth was dry. A few rocks lay scattered where people must have thrown them. The one other thing that had fallen to the bottom was an old crisp packet. Illuminated by the torch, the well bottom reminded me of the surface of the moon as I had seen it on television so long ago. The well's cylindrical concrete wall was blank and smooth, with few irregularities other than some clumps of moss-like stuff growing here and there. It shot straight upward like a chimney, with the little half-moon of light at the opening far above. Looking directly up, I could now grasp how very deep the well was. I gave the rope ladder another hard tug. In my hands it felt firm and reassuring. As long as it remained in place, I could go back to the surface any time I wanted. Next, I took a deep breath. Apart from a slight smell of mold, there was nothing wrong with the air. My greatest worry had been the air. The air at the bottom of a well tends to stagnate, and dry wells can have poison gases that seep from the earth. Long before, I had read in the paper about a well digger who lost his life from methane gas at the bottom of a well. Taking a breath, I sat on the floor of the well, with my back against the wall. I closed my eyes and let my body become accustomed to the place. All right then, I thought. Here I am, in the bottom of a well.
6. Inheriting property? Inquiry on jellyfish? Something like a sense of detachment. I sat in the dark. Far above me, like a sign of something, floated the perfect half-moon of light defined by the well cap, and yet none of the light from up there managed to find its way to the bottom. As time passed, my eyes became more accustomed to the darkness. Before long, I could just about make out the shape of my hand if I brought it close to my face. Other things around me began slowly to take on their own dim shapes, like timid little animals letting down their guard in the most gradual stages imaginable. As much as my eyes became used to it, though, the darkness never ceased to be darkness. Anything I tried to focus on would lose its shape and burrow its way soundlessly into the surrounding obscurity. Perhaps this could be called pale darkness. But pale as it might be, it had its own particular kind of density, which in some cases contained a more meaningful darkness than perfect pitch darkness. In it you could see something, and at the same time you could see nothing at all. Here in this darkness, with its strange sense of significance, my memories began to take on a power they had never had before. The fragmentary images they called up inside me were mysteriously vivid in every detail, to the point where I felt I could grasp them in my hands. I closed my eyes and brought back the time 8 years earlier when I had first met Kumiko.
It happened in the visitors' waiting room of the university hospital in Kanda. I had to go to the hospital almost every day back then to see a wealthy client concerning the inheritance of his property. Kumiko came to the hospital every day between classes in order to tend to her mother, who was there with a duodenal ulcer. She wore jeans or a short skirt and a sweater, her hair in a ponytail. Sometimes she would wear a coat, sometimes not, depending on the early November weather. She had a shoulder bag and always carried a few books that looked like university texts, plus some kind of sketch pad. The afternoon of the very first day I went to the hospital, Kumiko was there, sitting on the sofa with her legs crossed, wearing black low-heeled shoes and concentrating on a book. I sat opposite her, checking my watch every 5 minutes until the time for the interview with my client, which had been moved back an hour and a half for some reason I was not aware of. Kumiko didn't raise her eyes from the book. She had very nice legs. Looking at her helped to brighten my spirits somewhat. I found myself wondering what it must feel like to have such a nice, or at least extremely intelligent, face and great legs. After we had seen each other in the waiting room several times, Kumiko and I began to indulge in small talk, exchanging magazines we had finished reading or eating fruit from a gift basket someone had brought her mother. We were incredibly bored, after all, and in need of someone our own age to talk to. Kumiko and I felt something for each other from the start. It was not one of those strong, impulsive feelings that can hit two people like an electric shock when they first meet, but something quieter and gentler, like two tiny lights traveling in tandem through a vast darkness and drawing imperceptibly closer to each other as they go. As our meetings grew more frequent, I felt not so much that I had met someone new as that I had chanced upon a dear old friend. Soon I found myself dissatisfied with the bitty little conversations we were fitting in between other things in the hospital area. I kept wishing I could meet her somewhere else, so that we could really talk to each other for a change. Finally, one day, I decided to ask her for a date. "I think both of us could use a change of air," I said. "Let's get out of here and go somewhere else, where there aren't any patients or clients." Kumiko gave it some thought and suggested, "The aquarium?" And so the aquarium is where we had our first date. Kumiko brought her mother a change of clothes that Sunday morning and met me in the hospital waiting room. It was a warm, clear day, and Kumiko was wearing a simple white dress under a pale blue cardigan. I was always struck by how well she dressed even then. She could wear the plainest article of clothing and manage with the roll of a sleeve or the curl of a collar to transform it into something spectacular. It was a knack she had, and I could see that she took care of her clothes with an attention bordering on love. Whenever I was with her, walking beside her, I would find myself staring in admiration at her. Her blouses never had a wrinkle. Her pleats hung in perfect alignment. Anything white she wore looked brand new. Her shoes were never scuffed or smudged. Looking at what she wore, I could imagine her blouses and sweaters neatly folded and lined up in her chest of drawers, her skirts and dresses in plastic wrappers hanging in the wardrobe, which is exactly what I found to be the case after we were married. We spent that first afternoon together in the aquarium of the Ueno Zoo. The weather was so nice that day, I thought it might be more fun to stroll around the zoo itself, and I hinted as much to Kumiko on the train to Ueno, but it was obvious she had made up her mind to go to the aquarium. If that was what she wanted, it was all right with me. At the aquarium, there was a special display of jellyfish, and we went through them from beginning to end, viewing the rare specimens gathered from all parts of the world. They floated, trembling in their tanks, everything from a tiny cotton puff the size of a fingertip to monsters more than 3 feet in diameter. For a Sunday, the aquarium was relatively uncrowded. In fact, it was on the empty side. On such a lovely day, anybody would have preferred the elephants and giraffes to jellyfish. Although I said nothing to Kumiko, I actually hated jellyfish. I had often been stung by jellyfish while swimming in the ocean as a boy. Once, when swimming far out by myself, I wandered into a whole school of them. By the time I realized what I had done, I was surrounded. I never forgot the slimy, cold feeling of them touching me.
In the center of that whirlpool of jellyfish, an immense terror overtook me, as if I had been dragged into a bottomless darkness. I wasn't stung for some reason, but in my panic I gulped a lot of seawater, which is why I would have liked to skip the jellyfish display if possible and go to see some ordinary fish, like tuna or flounder. Kumiko, though, was fascinated. She stopped at every single tank, leaned over the railing, and remained transfixed as if she had lost all sense of time.
"Look at this," she'd say to me. "I never knew there were such vivid pink jellyfish, and look at the beautiful way it swims. They just keep wobbling along like this until they've been to every ocean in the world. Aren't they wonderful?"
"Yeah, sure." But the more I forced myself to keep examining jellyfish with her, the more I felt a tightness growing in my chest. Before I knew it, I had stopped replying to her and was counting the change in my pocket over and over, or wiping the corners of my mouth with my handkerchief. I kept wishing we would come to the last of the jellyfish tanks, but there was no end to them. The variety of jellyfish swimming in the oceans of the world was enormous. I was able to bear it for half an hour, but the tension was turning my head into mush. When finally it became too painful for me to stand leaning against the railing, I left Kumiko's side and slumped on a nearby bench. She came over to me and, clearly very concerned, asked if I was feeling ill. I answered honestly that looking at the jellyfish was making me dizzy. She stared into my eyes with a grave expression on her face.
"It's true," she said. "I can see it in your eyes. They've gone out of focus. It's incredible, just from looking at jellyfish."
Kumiko took me by the arm and led me out of the gloomy, dank aquarium into the sunlight. Sitting in the nearby park for 10 minutes, taking long, slow breaths, I managed to return to a normal psychological state. The strong autumn sun cast its pleasant radiance everywhere, and the bone-dry leaves of the ginkgo trees rustled softly whenever the breeze picked up.
"Are you all right?"
Kumiko asked after several minutes had gone by.
"You certainly are a strange one. If you hate jellyfish so much, you should have said so right away, instead of waiting until they made you sick."
The sky was high and cloudless. The wind felt good. The people spending their Sunday in the park all wore happy expressions. A slim, pretty girl was walking a large, long-haired dog. An old fellow wearing a felt hat was watching his granddaughter on the swing. Several couples sat on benches, as we were doing. Off in the distance, someone was practicing scales on a saxophone.
"Why do you like jellyfish so much?" I asked.
"I don't know. I guess I think they're sweet," she said. "But one thing did occur to me when I was focusing on them. What we see before us is just one tiny part of the world. We get into the habit of thinking this is the world, but that's not true at all. The real world is in a much darker and deeper place than this, and most of it is occupied by jellyfish and things. We just happen to forget all that. Don't you agree? 2/3 of the Earth's surface is ocean, and all we can see of it with the naked eye is the surface, the skin. We hardly know anything about what's underneath the skin."
We took a long walk after that. At 5 o'clock, Kumiko said she had to go back to the hospital, so I took her there.
"Thank you for a lovely day,"
she said when we parted. There was a quiet glow in her smile that had not been there before. When I saw it, I realized that I had managed to draw a little closer to her in the course of the day, thanks, no doubt, to the jellyfish. Kumiko and I continued to date. Her mother was discharged from hospital, and I no longer had to spend time there working on my client's will, but we would get together once a week for a movie or a concert or a walk. We grew closer to each other each time we met. I enjoyed being with her, and if we should happen to touch, I felt a fluttering in the chest. I often found it difficult to work when the weekend was drawing near. I was sure she liked me, otherwise she wouldn't see me every weekend. Still, I was in no hurry to deepen my relationship with Kumiko. I sensed a kind of uncertainty in her. Exactly what it was I couldn't have said, but it would have come out every now and then in her words or actions. I might ask her something, and a single breath would intervene before she answered, just the slightest hesitation, but in that split-second interval I sensed a kind of shadow. Winter came, and then the new year. We went on seeing each other every week.
I never asked about that something, and she never said a word. We would meet and go somewhere and eat and talk about innocuous things. One day I took a chance and said, "You must have a boyfriend, don't you?" Kumiko looked at me for a moment and asked, "What makes you think so?" "Just a hunch," I said. We were walking through the wintry and deserted Shinjuku Imperial Gardens.
"What kind of hunch?"
"I don't know. I get the feeling there's something you want to tell me. You should, if you can." The expression on her face wavered the slightest bit, almost imperceptibly. There might have been a moment of uncertainty, but there had never been any doubt about her conclusion.
"Thanks for asking," she said. "But I don't have anything that I want to make a special point of talking about."
"You haven't answered my question, though."
"About whether I have a boyfriend?"
"Uh-huh." Kumiko came to a stop. Then she slipped her gloves off and put them into her coat pocket. She took my gloveless hand in hers. Her hand was warm and soft. When I squeezed her hand in return, it seemed to me that her breaths grew smaller and whiter.
"Can we go to your apartment now?"
she asked. "Sure," I said, somewhat taken aback. "It's not much of a place, though." I was living in Asagaya at the time, in a one-room apartment with a tiny kitchen and a toilet and a shower the size of a phone booth. It was on the second floor and faced south, overlooking a construction company's storage yard. That southern aspect was the apartment's only good point. For a long time, Kumiko and I sat next to each other in the flood of sunlight, leaning against the wall. I made love to her for the first time that day. It was what she wanted, I was sure. In a sense, it was she who seduced me. Not that she ever said or did anything overtly seductive. But when I put my arms around her naked body, I knew for certain that she had intended this to happen. Her body was soft and offered no resistance. It was Kumiko's first experience of sex. For a long time afterwards, she said nothing. I tried several times to talk to her, but she made no reply. She took a shower, put her clothes on, and sat in the sunlight again. I had no idea what to say. I simply joined her in the patch of sunlight and said nothing. The two of us edged along the wall as the sun moved. When evening came, Kumiko said she was leaving. I saw her home. "Are you sure you don't have something you want to say to me?" I asked again in the train. She shook her head.
"Never mind about that," she murmured.
I never raised the topic again. Kumiko had chosen to sleep with me of her own volition, and if she was indeed keeping something inside that she could not tell me, this would probably be resolved in the course of time. We continued our weekly dates after that, part of which now included stopping by my apartment for sex more often than not. As we held and touched each other, she began to talk about herself more and more, about the things she had experienced, about the thoughts and feelings these things had given her. And I began to understand the world as Kumiko saw it. I found myself able, too, to talk with Kumiko about the world as I saw it. I came to love her deeply, and she said she never wanted to leave me. We waited for her to graduate from college, and then we got married. We were happy with our married life and had no problems to speak of, and yet there were times when I couldn't help sensing an area inside Kumiko to which I had no access. In the middle of the most ordinary or the most excited conversation, and without the slightest warning, she might sink into silence. It would happen all of a sudden, for no reason at all, or at least no reason I could discern. It was like walking along the road and all of a sudden falling into a pit. Her silences never lasted very long, but afterwards, until a fair amount of time had gone by, it was as if she were not really there. The first time I went inside Kumiko, I sensed a strange kind of hesitation. Kumiko should have been feeling only pain this first time for her, and indeed she kept her body rigid with the pain she was experiencing, but that was not the only reason for the hesitation I seemed to feel. There was something oddly lucid there, a sense of separation, of distance, though I don't know exactly what to call it. I was seized by the bizarre thought that the body I was holding in my arms was not the body of the woman I had had next to me until a few moments earlier. The two of us engaged in intimate conversation.
A switch had been pulled without my noticing, and someone else's flesh had taken its place. While I held her, my hands continued to caress her back. The touch of her small, smooth back had an